Let us look together at the book of Nehemiah, chapter 6. Nehemiah, chapter 6. And we want to read verses 5 through 9 and consider these verses together now. Nehemiah 6. And it says, "Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, It is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king, according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, There is a king in Judah. And now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. Then I sent unto him, saying, There are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. For they all made us afraid, saying, Their hands shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." May the Lord bless the reading of His Word. We have seen the enemies of God and the enemies of God's people here in the book of Nehemiah, opposing the mission upon which Nehemiah came to Jerusalem, which was to rebuild the wall and the gates around the city. That building project amounted to a kind of fortification of the city. There were houses built in the city. And, of course, the temple had been rebuilt sometime before this. But putting a wall around the city gave it a whole different character as a protected, fortified city. And this was especially troublesome to these characters who have been identified. They were identified by name here as recently as verse 1, Sanballat and Tobiah. And Geshem. These enemies were determined to do one thing: stop the project, stop the building. If there's any doubt about that, verse 9 confirms that. They all made us afraid, saying, Their hands shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. That was their goal. Whatever they had to do to get the work to stop. They had been successful, or at least someone had been successful at that in a previous attempt. Nehemiah, however, is determined to see it through this time. But these enemies would stop at nothing. They were determined to stop the work and reverse it, really, and tear down the work at all cost. The cost of a human life was nothing to them. An assassination plot against Nehemiah didn't trouble their consciences at all, it seems. As we saw in the opening verses of this chapter, these repeated efforts, four times, and what we have here today is actually the fifth time, they sent to him four times this request, this demand, come, meet with us in the plain of Ono, verse 2, which was about midway between Jerusalem and Samaria. Get him away from home and safety, lure him into this remote location for peace talks so that they might assassinate him. As he puts it at the end of verse 2, they thought to do me mischief. Beloved, we should never underestimate the determination of the enemies of the gospel to oppose the truth and to oppose those who stand for the truth. They will stop at nothing. Satan himself will stop at nothing. At least as long as God gives him a chain, God gives him a leash, he will stop at nothing. He will use every avenue, every scheme, every angle imaginable in order to stop the cause of God and the cause of the gospel in this world. And we should not be surprised when we observe that or when we are on the receiving end of that. Do you expect the devil to be a friend? Is this vile world a friend to grace? To help me on to God? Sometimes I think we should understand our theology that totally depraved sinners behave like totally depraved sinners. Well, here they are at work once again. They make this fifth attempt to lure him, to lure Nehemiah away from Jerusalem. You almost wonder if they're getting desperate here. I mean, four times he's rejected them, and so they add a dimension to this fifth effort that was not there before. It is an open letter. Now, you know, oftentimes communications between leaders of nations or provinces will be sealed only for that person to open and read. Well, here is a messenger sent with an open letter. And what does that mean? Well, it means anybody between Samaria, which is where we think Sanballat probably lived, anyone that this messenger encountered in that journey is going to see that he's a messenger, an official messenger. And what's the message? Well, here it is. I can show it. Here, you can read it for yourself. This is a way, of course, to spread the rumor, this malicious rumor that they wanted to perpetuate. Well, let's look at the rumor in particular. It's in verse 6 and 7, wherein was written, "It is reported among the heathen." Now, the heathen here are, this is Nehemiah's wording in a sense. The word simply means the people, the nations. This would be the provinces surrounding Judea, the neighboring peoples. It is reported among them. Let me put that in modern vernacular. Unidentified sources deemed credible have informed us that you are mounting an insurrection. Now, does that sound familiar? That sound like mainstream media recently? You know, what works for evil in politics works for evil in religion also. Rumor has it. And in this case, it's everyone is talking about it. Everyone knows this. It's reported among the heathen. Of course, this was the first that Nehemiah or anyone with him had heard of anything like this. News comes to them, oh, this has spread like wildfire. Everybody's talking about it all over the world. And I think it's just interesting to see the method here. There is nothing new under the sun. The wicked misrepresent the case by attributing to a large number the thoughts of only one or two. As I said, when this messenger, as he's traveling along with this open letter, that he's more than willing, he'll open it and show it to anybody that will give him an opportunity. Those are the only ones that are talking about it. Are those who had some connection with the source, Sanballat. Again, in today's language, this would be called astroturf. This is astroturf. And that's simply to say what would be represented as a grassroots concern. Concern has just sprung up all over the region here, Nehemiah. Everybody knows, everybody's talking about it. And the fact is, there was no grassroots sudden uprising. This is fake news. This is fake grass. This is astroturf. This has all comes from one source, and Nehemiah recognizes that, as we will see. You can make applications again to the world of politics, and you know, you've seen some of the clips like I have of newscasters from half a dozen different organizations, all using identical phrases the same day, as if they're all getting their information from the same, you know, from a single source, and so on. Well, that's what's going on here. There is nothing new. Human nature has been the same since Genesis chapter 3 in the Garden of Eden after the fall. Now, the second thing I think is interesting here is this. A man named Gashmu, and in the margin of your Bible, this is Geshem. This is just a variation of his name. Confirms it. Says it. Sanballat sends this word, this messenger, with this open letter to Nehemiah, and he says, if you don't believe me, you can ask Geshem. And of course, if Nehemiah had gone and asked Geshem, what would he have said? You can ask Sanballat. He's the proof. He's the testimony. He will confirm this. Again, to use modern terminology, this is an echo chamber. This is Sanballat saying, well, Geshem said. Geshem would say, well, Sanballat said. Nobody wants to take credit or blame for it. So the rumor that they started and did all they could to spread was, you're planning a rebellion. You have built this wall that's almost finished now with the intent of having this fortified city over which you can reign as king. You will be coronated and give competition to Artaxerxes. And you have messengers of your own, verse 7. Prophets appointed to preach of thee at Jerusalem. Nehemiah, you've got this carefully laid scheme. Everybody's talking. Everybody knows all about it now. You can't hide it anymore. You've got these heralds that are declaring or getting ready to declare the message that you are a king in Judah. This violates the Sedition Act, Nehemiah. And of course, this was pure, malicious lie fabrication altogether. God's people, God's servants have been subject to this kind of malicious slander in every generation, and we ought to expect it. Now that's the rumor, but there's a second component here, and that's the threat at the end of verse, or in the middle of verse 7. Now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Nehemiah, this rumor is bound to reach King Artaxerxes, king of Persia, in Shushan the palace. You can be sure that Sanballat would see to it that word reached the king. If he had to send his messenger for that lengthy journey with this open letter, he would make sure that this came to pass. There is something of a pretty thinly veiled threat here. The word of this will definitely reach the king. And then what? You are in big trouble, Nehemiah. Nehemiah could well lose his life for treason if this rumor spread to the king. And so, here's the solution. Here's how you can avoid this at the end of verse 7. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. This has been their intent for the previous four communications. Now they've got him in a corner to where he cannot refuse to come. Nehemiah, you must come to Ono and meet with us. After all, it's in your best interest. If you come and meet with us, we will make sure that none of this reaches the ears of the king. We need to talk. You need my help. And what he's really saying to Nehemiah is, you are at my mercy. I'm offering you an opportunity to clear your name, to prove that these claims are false. If you agree to meet with me and carry out that meeting, you will demonstrate your own integrity. And you will prove that these rumors are false. Well, I keep using modern terms here. This is called political hardball. And Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem had perfected the art. Here are the enemies feigning a little friendship, pinning Nehemiah into a corner, while all along their original plan of doing him mischief, which I think surely included or would include taking his life, was still their plan. If that was what it took for the work to stop, then that was a small price to pay as far as they were concerned. The plan was to put fear in their hearts, either to get Nehemiah there and kill him and destroy the momentum and the leadership that God had established there with him, or in some way at least, to weaken their hands from the work, verse 9, and to get the work to stop. Look at verse 9 once again. For they all made us afraid, saying, their hands shall be weakened from the work that it be not done. Notice the connection between fear and paralysis. Fear would stop the work. Fear has a paralyzing influence. And that was what these enemies wanted to accomplish, was just to put absolute fear in Nehemiah and in all of them. And the way it's worded here makes us think that maybe they were a little successful at first. They all made us afraid. But, of course, Nehemiah regained courage and strengthened his own heart in the Lord. And as we see here, he prays for the Lord's strength. He was able to resist this fear and overcome it. Now, before we look at Nehemiah's response, let me just point this out. If anyone in this scene was scheming against the king of Persia, it was not Nehemiah, was it? It was Sanballat. He's the one who is opposing the governor, Nehemiah, who has been duly appointed by Artaxerxes. It is Sanballat who wants to set himself up as the real power to be reckoned with in the region of Palestine. He's guilty of what he accuses Nehemiah of in practical terms. Does that sound familiar? I think they call that projecting nowadays. Accusing others of what they are doing, what they themselves are doing. Nothing new under the sun. We see human nature, well, we see fallen human nature at its worst here in Nehemiah. And we see renewed, regenerated nature at its best, do we not, in the book of Nehemiah also. It is so common for people to project and to accuse others of what they are guilty of themselves. I've had pastor friends who have said to me over the years, whenever someone comes and complains that there's no love in the church, they are the problem. They are accusing others of their own sin. And that resonated with me when I read an account, or heard actually, an account told by a man, a minister. He knew this. I suppose he had been told by Martin Lloyd-Jones himself. He said one day after a service, it was Lloyd-Jones's custom to meet with individuals in his study after the church service. And sometimes people would wait and there would be a long line. And he would stay there and talk with folks as long as they were willing to stay and wait for him. But a woman came in to his study and she was angry and she said, there's no love in this church. Lloyd-Jones, being an older, wiser man, recognized immediately that she was the problem. And he said to her, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, calm down and tell me what's going on in your life. What is your problem? What are you struggling with? What are you facing in your life? And was able to help her and to enable her to realize that her problem was herself, that she wanted to blame on others. That's just one way that people project, as they say. That's what Sanballat is doing here. He's got this whole case against Nehemiah. And if he had but examined his own heart, he would have seen that he was far more prone to what he was accusing the other man of than anyone else. Well, let's look at Nehemiah's response. Now, he knew this was false. He knew his own heart. As soon as he hears this report, he knows, I mean, his conscience is clear. He knows that he's not trying to establish himself as a king, that he has not appointed heralds to declare him king and go before him with horns and cymbals to give him a victory parade or anything like that. He also knew that this whole rumor was concocted by Sanballat himself. And as you can see in his response in verse 8, he knew that this was no grassroots concern all over the region. He could see through that immediately. That was just some God-given discretion and wisdom. But he also knew that if this did reach the king, if this rumor, this utterly false rumor, reached the king, it could cause enormous trouble. No telling where it would go, including the loss of his life. And though Nehemiah is a man of prayer, he's also a man of like passions as we are. And I wonder if perhaps he spent a sleepless night before he returns the message, the answer. And in that night, he's rehearsing in his mind all of the potential harm that could come from this. If this happens, and that'll happen, or else that could happen, and the king could do this, and this could turn into that. I'm sure Nehemiah knew that refusing to meet with Sanballat would be spun and portrayed as an admission of guilt. Refusing to meet with Sanballat would be to admit that the rumor was true. And, of course, the report that would then reach the king would be, Nehemiah has admitted to all of this. The very fact that he refused to come and meet with us proves beyond a doubt that this is all the fact. Of course, if Nehemiah had agreed to go and meet and had not lost his life in the process, that would have been spun against him also. It's as if he can't win. Coming and meeting with them would be, oh, well, see, he's guilty. He's got a guilty conscience. He's trying to get out of this now. So what should he do? Well, he obviously refused to meet with Sanballat and the others. And I think it's noteworthy here that though he does deny the false allegation, he does not descend into a defense of himself in any particulars. He refused to be intimidated on the one hand, and he refused to be embittered in his own soul on the other hand. I mean, for some of us, this might have been the last straw. It's not worth risking your life. It's not No, Nehemiah did not allow bitterness to conquer him. Here is spiritual maturity on display. And what Nehemiah did can simply be classified with two things. Number one, in verse 8, he flatly denies the malicious allegations. He sends a return message saying, "There are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart." Nehemiah exposes the source of the rumor. He says, in so many words, "Sanballat, you know as well as I do that there's not a word of truth to any of this. You started the rumor. It's not reported among the peoples. You're the one who has fabricated the whole thing." And in so many words, he says, "Sanballat, I'm not afraid of you." Sanballat wanted to work fear in the heart of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah's answer shows no fear. Sanballat's mission failed. Nehemiah implies here, we're going to finish the work. We're going to keep on working until the wall and the gates. They'd already finished the wall for the most part. They still had to hang the gates. We're going to keep on working. That's the first thing. Just a simple denial of the false allegation. Secondly, he prays. And he, in his memoirs here, he just makes the transition from narrative to prayer that it catches us by surprise. "Now therefore, strengthen my hands." And our translators have supplied the address to God, which is obviously the one to whom he's praying here. "Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." We've seen so many prayers thus far in Nehemiah, and there are more yet to come. This is just one of those short outbursts. Sensing his own weakness, he calls upon the Lord for strength, for help. To descend into defending himself from these allegations would be a waste of time. His enemies, or anybody who believed the rumors, would believe them regardless of his denials. And his friends, of course, knew better and didn't need his self-defense. And so he simply commits the matter to God and waits for God to show his hand. He waits for God to vindicate him. He has no idea whether this rumor will in fact reach the ears of the king. It may. And if it does, then what? He has to leave it with the Lord. And Jehovah is Lord, not only over Jerusalem and over Samaria, but over Shushan and every place. And so these are the two simple things that Nehemiah did. He just makes a statement to deny the false report, and then he prays. And surely this is the best course in circumstances like these. You know, there's a passage there in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul, by inspiration, no doubt, entered into some self-defense with the Corinthians. He does so hesitatingly. He would rather not do so. They force him to do that. And perhaps there's a time for that. But normally the best course is simply to deny the rumors and leave the matter with God. Commit it to His hands. And then keep on doing what God has given you to do. Nehemiah gets back to work. Let me just make two or three closing observations here. You know, they say all is well that ends well. Well, maybe we can say this. All is well that ends in prayer. And though Sanballat intended evil to Nehemiah and all concerned, what was the end result, at least thus far, of everything? We leave the passage here with Nehemiah on his knees before God. And beloved, whatever drives us to God has done us a favor. You can say, in spite of his intent to the contrary, Sanballat did Nehemiah a favor, didn't he? Because he forced him to draw closer to God and to stay close to God and to pray unto God. Sanballat's efforts failed miserably. Matthew Henry says, Christian fortitude will be sharpened by opposition. Every temptation to draw us from duty should quicken us so much the more to duty. May it be so with us. Let us, by God's grace, turn evil on its head, regardless of its source and its method. Let us turn evil on its head by taking it as an occasion to pray, to draw near to God. This is the defeat of Satan. If his arrows that he shoots at us drive us to our knees before God. Another thing to observe, let us be sure that we are not hostile to government, that rumors of rebellion or insurrection are in fact false. Let us make sure that we have no ambitions for ourselves to set up ourselves as some kind of king. I know this is just a brief statement on a complex subject, but let us make sure that we are not hostile to God-ordained government. Nehemiah was not trying to overthrow Artaxerxes. Now, in our context today, there's something to be said for upholding constitutional freedoms. Not that the U.S. Constitution grants us any freedom. The Constitution simply acknowledges God-given freedoms that of necessity must exist. But we do have at least the advantage in our context today of a document that sets that forth. And we should take advantage of it, and we should seek to defend it. And that opens a can of worms that is too big to put a lid on here today. But may God give us wisdom to be good citizens of the earthly kingdom in which God has put us. And last of all, though Nehemiah had no ambition to be king, he was in fact preparing a city for a king. According to prophecy, the Lord Jesus Christ, our prophet, priest, and king, would come to his temple. Even the messenger of the covenant, as Malachi says, there was significance in this building project beyond what met the eye of certainly the Gentile world, and I don't know how many even within the realm of the Jews understood all of this. But Nehemiah was not building a city for himself to rule over. He's building a place for the King of Glory to come and to minister, and in which to die on the cross for our salvation. And so what Nehemiah was doing here was very important. And let us recognize the importance of the work that we do. It's not that we ourselves are important. It is the Lord's work that's important. It is the King that we serve that is important. And let us take seriously and be faithfully committed unto the work of our King, the Lord Jesus Christ.